Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Alfonso Cuarón's new film, Gravity. And joining me in the Slate studio is Forrest Wickman, Slate contributor, browbeat writer. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Dana.
And also John Swansburg, editorial director of Slate.
Hey, Dana. Hey, Forrest.
Hey, John.
Three-way conversation.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, this is actually the first time we've had three people on a spoiler in quite a while. So we all saw Gravity separately, and we've been trying to preserve our reaction for this moment. So now, here goes. I'm going to ask you both just quickly to give a reaction, and then we'll get into some spoilage. So, John, you first. What do you think?
I love this movie. Forrest and I actually saw it a little over a week ago, and I have to say, it stayed with me in a way. Like the visceral experience of having seen it, I still like sort of have a tingle when I think about how excellent it was. Although the plot, which we'll discuss in a moment, hasn't stuck with me as much. It's not really a movie about plot in a lot of ways, but I loved sitting in the theater watching this movie. It was probably the most fun 90 minutes in the movies that I've had in a couple of years, just purely fun.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree. I mean, it's a strange combination with this movie that I would eagerly send people there. Basically, anyone who's even remotely interested in Alfonso Cuarón or space or George Clooney or Sandra Bullock, I would say, run and see Gravity. And yet, I don't think it's a masterpiece, and I want to get to why that is. But what about you, Forrest?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the screenplay has some problems, but it was just, you know, at one point in the movie, they say something about how the next thing Bullock does is going to be one hell of a ride, and two of my notes were amusement park ride and wee. and yeah, so I just thought it was a lot of fun and one of the more transporting experiences, frequently sort of beautiful, like the shots of Earth and the feeling of being in space, as well as terrifying, and one of the more transporting movies I've seen since like Avatar.
So I think we should open up with talking about how it looks and feels, this movie, and this kind of sensory experience of being inside it. And I think we should approach that through the first shot, which in Cuarón style is an incredibly long, yeah, kind of virtuoso long take, with the difference that because almost all the backgrounds in this movie, all the backgrounds, essentially everything except the actors' faces and a little bit of their bodies, is being rendered in CGI, very elaborate CGI that doesn't look anything like the sci-fi CGI that we're used to. Anyway, so obviously that take means something different when it's all sort of happening inside a computer, but I think you could safely say that there's not a cut in this movie for the first 20 minutes or
it's
so.
It's when she detaches is the first cut, and yeah, I think it's like...
Oh, that makes sense. She gets cut off.
The rumor early on was that it was like 17 minutes, and that's what it felt like.
Yeah. And so what do we see? Help me describe the trippy experience of those first 20 minutes. While describing the plot, folding that
yeah,
in skillfully.
It starts
as well.
With
Forrest.
This sort of fun, sort of like very self-serious to an almost silly level message on the screen about space, how there's like no sound and it was not like never meant for human life or something.
Life is impossible in space. That's the very last legend
right,
that you see before
right,
it starts.
Right. And then we sort of cut from that to George Clooney admiring, I don't know, Earth or the sunrise or something. So we meet him. He plays an astronaut named Matt Kowalski, I think it is. And then there's Ryan Stone, who's sort of an engineer in space, who's played by Sandra Bullock. And she's fixing what none of us could remember what it was exactly. We were just talking about this, but I guess it was the Hubble telescope. All of this becomes very insignificant because while she's fixing it, some space debris suddenly comes hurtling towards them, and that's when sort of everything starts flying in various directions in total chaos.
Right.
And then Sandra Bullock detaches and flies off into space. And that's everything you've seen in the trailer, which, you know, I've sat in some theaters where people are like, whoa, was that the end of the movie? Like, where could the movie go from here?
I actually was like so ignorant. I wanted to be surprised by what happened in this film, and I didn't know if what came next after the debris wrecked the space shuttle and sort of sent Bullock spinning out into space, like whether she was going to meet some aliens
or
like,
no,
you know,
I was
like
the same
exactly
way.
Because it happens pretty early in the movie, right? After the 20-minute shot, so about 20 minutes in, and she's hurtling through space for quite a long time, so long that I would love a physicist to tell me whether she in fact would have spun too far away from the ship to possibly be savable. Of course, that's presuming that we have jetpacks that George Clooney can jet around
right,
space on.
Right. Yeah, I would say the effect of the trailer is sort of immediately ruined when the movie starts and George Clooney has a jetpack and you're like, oh, that's how they get Sandra Bullock back.
Right, he jetpacks over to her and
but there's something
her
so funny to go back for a minute into that 20-minute shot about the moment you first see Clooney, because you don't actually see him first. You see, you know, this really wide, amazingly spinning kind of shot where basically the world is moving around the actors, yeah, right? You sort of feel like you're orbiting around them, and you see Sandra Bullock fixing this thing from afar and kind of the, you know, stars against the background, and at a certain point in this stationary shot comes scoot, 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 like this little figure.
Yeah.
And just the moment that you realize it's George Clooney, both because it's his familiar, you know,
yeah,
suave, mellow voice in space, and then just his face behind the visor was just really funny and charming to me. Just George Clooney in space, that in itself is a good thing.
And he's basically playing like the George Clooney of astronauts. Like he's this astronaut.
Yeah, he's Danny Ocean in space.
Right, yeah, exactly. He's on his like umpteenth trip. He's annoyed because he's going to come. He's a veteran, and I think it's been decided it's his last trip to space, and he's just shy. He's like 6 hours shy of breaking someone's record for like the most
time. So it's like the cop movie of one last job. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's annoyed. He's complaining back to Mission Control, which is voiced by Ed Harris. You know, like, why couldn't we stay up here longer? I could have beat that guy. And he's sort of listening to country music over his PA and just jabbering on about his past experiences. And he's just incredibly charming and Clooney-ish.
Yeah.
But in space.
Right.
And
yeah.
I think that the casting of George Clooney is the only reason that that character works at all. Because when everything goes down, that character continues to just be incredibly calm and suave and under control, which is just, I don't know, astronauts are amazing, so maybe that's how they would really be. But it was very hard. It would be hard for me to picture and relate to if it was anybody but George Clooney. And because it was like, oh, of course he's calm because he's George Clooney.
Right. Space has no effect on Clooney. Clooney at zero gravity is Clooney.
So as long as we're spoiling, let's talk about what happens. We don't have to get into every detail, but there's a lot that happens that could not be talked about in a review, which is really why I'm glad we're spoiling this movie on this podcast, after she spins out into space. So she spins out for a very long time. Then, chug, chug, along comes George Clooney in his backpack. And then how does it come to be that she is isolated in a Soyuz trying to fly it back to Earth?
Yeah. So Clooney sort of tows her back to, I guess they go to the International Space Station?
Well, first they go back to their own ship and realize that everyone has died in a really eerie part, right?
Yeah, there is a third astronaut who is killed
And also a couple
swiftly.
That were inside the shuttle,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Who sort of come out. It's like, did anyone else think it was a Jaws homage, maybe? There's that part where it's one of the like most famous scares in Jaws where they go into the dead ship. And because of that Jaws scene, I was just waiting for it. I was like, some dead person's head's going to pop up.
Yeah, kind of a horror movie classic, right? There has to be some core that bobs into view, but just the idea of like dying in space is just really horrifying. Yeah.
Well, we get that one close-up shot of the other astronaut who's out on the walk, and he's gotten a piece of debris that's gone right through his face, and there's just like a debris-shaped hole where his face used to be. It's one of the only gory moments. I think the only gory moment in the whole movie. I guess the bloated, you know, dead people are kind of gory too. But that one was like, you know, man with hole instead of face was pretty.
Yeah, it gets across that sense that space is not the place to be, you know?
For
it's
anyone
not a place
except for
to
George
sustain
Clooney.
Human life unless you're Clooney.
We should add that, so after they go to the, go back to the ship and find that everyone's dead and the ship is disabled, and also that they've lost communication with Houston,
Ed Harris.
With Ed Harris.
Ed Harris, who plays Mission Control in every space movie.
Right.
By contract.
He signed
13.
A lifetime agreement to be every Mission Control in every movie. So then they need to proceed to the International Space Station to see if they could get on one of the escape pods known as a Soyuz. But the thing that kind of gives the movie extra kind of momentum is that the band of space debris, which was created when the Russians blew up a satellite that was, I guess, no longer needed, is now in orbit. And so it's like it already cut through them, but it's about to, you know, come back around. So they only have, I guess, 90 minutes or something like that?
Something like that.
30 minutes, maybe even less, to get to the space station, get on that escape pod, and get out of there before they're going to get cut to pieces again.
Yeah, and that's a really effective, whether or not it makes any sense again with the laws of gravity, I have no idea, but that's a great kind of plot point, right? Because it means that you have a danger that's coming at a known time that you can pinpoint, and then in between you can do all this stuff with isolation and silence. So it's sort of, this movie does alternate really effectively, I think, between, you know, moments of kind of silence and contemplativeness and inwardness, and then just scary as hell action sequences.
Right.
So let's get to the big spoiler, the thing that I really can't reveal in a review, which is the fate of the Clooney character, Matt Kowalski. What did you guys think of that? So we're about maybe a little bit more than half an hour into the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Right about at the Janet Leigh point in Psycho.
Right.
And George Clooney disappears. He sacrifices himself.
Right.
And spoiler alert, I mean, which I really held on to the end of the movie, the idea that he might somehow reappear or she'd go rescue him, but that's it. He just floats off into space with his jetpack forever.
Right.
It seemed a little bit like Leo DiCaprio at the end of Titanic. Like, couldn't he have found some way around? I don't know. He just found so many workarounds for Sandra. I'm not quite sure why he sacrificed himself so early.
Yeah, it's a good point. Like, he's so sure of himself and so sure-footed, if one can be sure-footed in space, and kind of figures out everything, and they get finally to the International Space Station, and then they just have this kind of hard landing on the exterior of the space station, and then they bounce around a little bit, and then at a certain point, the movie contrives to make it so that the only way that Sandra Bullock can survive right. is if she lets go of Clooney, who's sort of like they're holding hands, and he's being dragged off into space by the force of his momentum, and she's sort of holding onto the space station with her foot, which is wrapped around a ribbon, which was attached to a parachute, which was attached to a previously deployed Soyuz, and he sort of says, well, it's either I let go and float off into space, or we both die, and so. She lets go, or he sort of lets go, contrives to let go, and that's the last we see of him. We kind of hear him talking a little bit over the radio as he floats away, and but that's it. Yeah, and then he's just gone, which is kind
of
a bummer.
Except for the dream sequence,
except
which we should discuss. And then that will actually segue nicely into the last thing I want to talk about, which is what we, I think, all felt were some of the script flaws and kind of thematic flaws of the second half. So he does reappear very, very close to the end after she's, as Forrest pointed out, bounced between several different pods and spacecraft from different countries, right? She basically is kind of making her way around this small sector of space, on like spit and a shoestring, right? She has right. she has nothing, but she's sort of finding her way into these abandoned crafts and trying to use them as best she can. And just when you really think that her goose is cooked, right? She's in she's running out of oxygen, I guess. She's just running out of oxygen in the Chinese pod at that point.
I think she's running out of time before the debris comes back.
Yeah, so she sort of decides to just let herself
That's
die.
Right. She lowers the oxygen herself. Yeah.
Right.
And at that moment, as she's basically passing out, right, you see George Clooney chug-chug come back in his jetpack, get in through the window, and for a glorious moment, you kind of think he's somehow impossibly made it back. And then you realize that he's a dream. He's just talking her through, essentially giving her inspiration to go on mm-hmm. living and also talking her through how she would operate this board with all these buttons in Chinese. So what did you guys think of both the imaginary return of Clooney, and how that fits into the movie's theme, which we haven't really gotten to, but about, rebirth and survival?
I think one is always happy to see George Clooney come back. I was momentarily confused. Part of me thought this can't be really happening, but who knows? Maybe Kowalski is such a skilled astronaut that he has figured out a way to come back. I was a little annoyed when it was revealed that it was a dream sequence, not because I didn't think it plausible that she might, as she was passing out, dream of George Clooney, because who among us hasn't dreamt of George Clooney as they were falling asleep? But I was annoyed that he somehow appeared to her and told her how to operate a Chinese escape pod. So that knowledge was somehow in her of subconscious,
very helpfully there were instructions at least, which I have no idea. I did read there was some fact check online, and it did say that it was sort of unlikely that anybody would be able to fly all these different kinds of spacecrafts, that they're sufficiently different.
Right.
That it would be.
So the fact that her ability to operate this spacecraft was contingent upon a helpful tip from a dream-born George Clooney seems sort of lame to me. But generally, I thought, the sequence is very charming, and Clooney gets to be Clooney for another few minutes, so that was kind of pleasant. But in terms of the rebirth thing, I feel like as you intimated, Dana, the plot with a sort of backstory of who Ryan Stone is sort of kind of hastily sketched and a little bit broad at the same time, and that part didn't really work for me. I don't know, Forrest, do you want to?
I agree that it was very broad. I like what the message was, which was basically they took, in that opening message at the beginning of the movie where they say no life can exist in space or whatever. You had it right. That's sort of like the alien point of view on space, where just everything is brutal and you can't survive. And then this movie combines it with but space is also really beautiful.
Right.
And then it tries to sort of resolve those things. And it's also sort of, about her life on Earth as well, because we learned that she's had this kid, but then he died in some incredibly random accident that is maybe...
She. It was a girl,
it was
right?
A daughter.
It was
a
girl. She. Okay. Yeah. And so she has to come to terms with that and let go, which is part of why you get extra weight when George Clooney's like, you have to learn to let go. And I think that was actually my biggest problem, was just the execution of it, which was lines like that. And then another line George Clooney gives when he says, you have to get your feet back on the ground. And then sure enough, at the end of the movie, not only does, just to skip to spoiling the ending, to the extent it's a spoiler, she goes back through the atmosphere in this Chinese escape pod, and she lands on Earth, and then she crawls out of the water that she's landed in, and then the last shot is she gets up on her 2 feet on the ground again.
Right, and it's kind of learning to walk again the way you do when you come back from space, so it's kind of like baby steps. I mean, I honestly think that that whole rebirth theme in the second half could have, I think it was like 4 individual lines of dialogue away from being great. It was just like it was punched a little bit too hard. There were too many moments that Clooney or somebody, some sort of theme had to return to, you know, the fact that essentially she had to work through her grief. It was a little bit chicken soup for the soul in the space pod. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And also, like, just the details of this, like the specifics of the narrative were kind of annoying. Like, as Forrest alluded to, the death of her daughter was in this incredibly random event. If I remember correctly, the daughter's like running across a playground and trips and falls and dies. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that happens more often than I know. Maybe America's playgrounds are death traps and like kids are dying every day from, you know, being concussed by a seesaw. But I just.
Gravity, man. It's gravity is the enemy in this movie.
Right. Gravity will get you on the planet Earth. It'll get you when you're in space. I don't know. I felt like that was like a little on the nose, right? To have this child taken from her in this utterly random, the universe is horrible kind of way, and then to sort of, you know, have that be the backdrop for being in space where, like, you know, nothing will save you. There's just cold, oxygenless air, and such is the state of the universe. I don't know. It felt like, you know, maybe couldn't the kid have died of cancer, you know?
Yeah. I think that might have been better.
That's funny. The method of death didn't bother me at all, but it had to do with just like, we get it. Like, a dead kid is sad. It doesn't need any embellishment. You know, you don't need to put any like frosting piping around that story. And that moment when she talks to the dead George Clooney and says like, say hi to my angel in heaven or something, that was a bridge too far for me. Yeah. But I will say, I mean, this is the cynic in me popping up later and finding holes in the script. I don't think the script is as profound as the visuals make it possible for this movie to be. And some of the ideas as well. I sort of love that there's this dialectic being played out in space between the humanist, George Clooney, you know, the guy who for whom life is possible in space and on Earth, you know, and Sandra Bullock, who seems to be this person for whom life wasn't really possible in either place before, you know. So, I mean, that is a really moving trajectory. And I actually did weep at the moment at the end when she, you know, rises up from the water in her arguably overly scanty undies and starts to walk on the surface of the Earth again. So I forgave the movie those sentimental excesses, but I did feel them.
I feel the same way. I felt like the cheesiness was only something I really thought about ex post facto. You know, when Forrest and I took the subway back home together afterwards, we started sort of nitpicking and talking about sort of, oh, that was kind of cheesy, that was a little heavy-handed. But when I was sitting there in the movie theater, you know, I was registering a little bit when they would put too fine a point on something, but for the most part, I'm just like, this is awesome. I really hope she makes it to the next space station. I hope she doesn't blow up as she reenters the atmosphere. I hope she lands in the water and not on a, you know, parking lot.
You're just really rooting for her
the whole time and just like completely immersed, and, you know, the cheesiness did not affect me. It worked for me in the moment, and I think you're right. Like, my cynic is also popping up a week later to you know... complain a little bit, but ultimately in the movie I think you'll be along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're watching the movie there's just no time to think. All you're thinking about is like, oh man, are her fingers going to grasp that next, you know, the last safety line that she has to grab before she hurtles off into space again.
Right, and the form also takes up a lot of, you know, it's just so visually dazzling and there's so many unexpected moments. It doesn't feel like any other science fiction epic I can think of, and I can't really, it's really experiential. You kind of have to just see it to see how that is.
Well, that's one of the things I like most about this movie, is like, if you think about it in comparison to something like Transformers or the Avengers, where they're these big tentpole blockbusters where the idea is they're going to provide a thrill by positing that there are giant robots that can transform into cars, or there are sort of people with superhuman talents. And then you take this, you compare it to this movie where really the excitement is she going to be able to open that hatch?
Right.
Like, you know, that's the drama, right? It's like, is she going to be able to figure out which button sequence like launches this pod? And it really, it's like, it's set in space, so it feels obviously supernatural in a way. But in fact, it's like, it feels also realistic. It's set in like our space present. And I'm sure the movie took some liberties with what, you know, this International Space Station is actually like, and what it's like to actually be on a spacewalk. But it feels like this is happening in our universe. And the concerns and the drama in some ways are so mundane, but that only makes them that much more gripping, I feel like, when you're watching the movie. And that's like, that's an incredible accomplishment by Cuarón, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it restores the mystery to space itself. It's like, we don't need giant flying robots for it to be amazing and cool and frightening and weird that these things are happening in space.
Right.
Dana, since you mentioned her space skivvies, we should briefly note
briefly
that when an astronaut strips off their suit, I guess they have like a much more elaborate getup that's underneath that is not quite so scanty. Though it's
Is there much rooting this about on the internet right now?
Oh, it was just in this post on Time, and so only one person brooding, as far as I can tell. But the one probably more notable thing is, I guess she would have had a space diaper on, like an adult diaper, which is, it's a little easy to see how that could ruin the moment. And just
that
be
one beautiful shot, you know, the shot where she's floating in front of the airlock and they're rotating in opposite directions. That would just be ruined by a diaper.
She goes sort of like into it, like a fetus on that.
Yeah,
right?
it's a great shot. And that, for example, when we're talking about the rebirth theme, that shot said it all. There really did not need to be very much dialogue about motherhood and maternity and rebirth and survival, you know, because that sort of fetal position shot in front of the round door kind of said it all. But a space diaper would completely have ruined
it. Ruined it, yeah.
And also, the shorts that she's wearing, the sort of spandex shorts.
Yeah, they're like biker shorts.
They're like biker shorts. She's not like wearing a thong. She's not wearing, you know, like frilly lace underwear. She's wearing something that looks like, I feel like I've seen, you know, women running around New York City in things like, in like shorts sort of like
totally.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe this is a moment to talk about the casting of Sandra Bullock. I think it's great that they cast a woman in this role that might more often go to, you know, a male action star or something. And I've, you know, heard griping from people who don't like Sandra Bullock. But I think she's great for this kind of role. I mean, it's sort of like a speed kind of thing. And
yeah,
she's good at it.
Back to
she's
speed.
Charming and she's really relatable and very down to earth. No pun intended.
There should be a movie every
Spoiler.
20 years where she has to propel some craft really fast through space.
I agree. I think she was great. And I think to your earlier point, Forrest, I sort of can't imagine this movie working without her or Clooney. Like it's so good, but their star power and their talents are called upon in every scene. I mean, there really aren't any other people in this movie besides the disembodied voice of Ed Harris.
Yeah.
So it's not an easy role to pull off. And I'm not quite sure who I would cast instead of Sandra Bullock.
Yeah, I would basically say that I thought she was borderline virtuosic. I mean, it's a pretty hard role to pull off. She's even more alone than Sigourney Weaver was in Alien for more of the movie, you know, and she has a lot. She has a lot on her shoulders. I think she was great.
And there's no alien, right? Like, there's nothing to play against. It's like she's playing against the sort of unforgiving.
The void.
Yeah. Right. And that's hard. I think that's harder.
Yeah, it's like Castaway or 127 Hours or something.
Right.
Both of which roles got those actors Oscars.
Speaking of Oscars, I just have to say that if Emmanuel Lubezki doesn't get an Oscar for this, there's truly, I mean, I'm done railing against Oscars, but he's been Cuarón's cinematographer forever, and he's just a magician. I mean, the stuff that he achieves in Children of Men and in this.
And in Terrence Malick
in
movies,
Terrence
too.
Malick movies
Tree
as well.
Of Life and To the Wonder.
And Tree of Life, oh my God. Just the look of those movies.
Yeah.
He creates completely his own visual language, and just he works with directors in some amazing way. I would love to hear the meetings where they decide what something should look like, because every thing he creates just has its own kind of visual life.
And this movie uses 3D very well also.
The tears coming at you. Did you guys like that?
I did. I mean, you know, it's like a little cheesy, but...
Two tears would have done it. There didn't need to be like six.
Yeah. And then at one point, one kind of like lands...
Hits the lens. That I didn't like.
And it has a reflection in it. That was a little bit too much. Like the way like a sunglasses in an 80s action movie would have a fireball reflected in them.
Right. That felt like Gilda Lily a little bit. Like I liked that they were coming at me, but then to have them hit the lens, it's sort of, if you stop and think about that, it's like it takes you out of the moment a little bit, because it's like, why is there a lens? You know, it should be just floating off
towards
Pluto.
You shouldn't be reminded that you're watching a movie for something as immersive like as this. Yeah,
right.
I mean, it's funny that it may be a callback to Children of Men, during which, you know, in the longest shot of the entire movie, some blood hit the lens in the middle of the shot. And somewhat famously, Cuarón thought the entire shot was ruined, and I guess even called cut. But nobody heard them, and so the entire thing continued. And then it was only afterwards that, you know, that they all... Well, he had figured it out, but that they all figured it out, and then they digitally removed it. So,
and now
which
he's
is interesting.
Digitally
I think that's the right choice, is to remove it, especially when it's like, when it's CGI water, like you have control. I didn't like that, but it's fine. I mean, nitpicking.
But otherwise, I thought whether or not you like the tears flying at you, I feel like the 3D was well handled. It made you feel like you were up in space with these guys in this way. I mean, I felt like both exhilarated, but also like nauseated, but in the best possible way at certain points of this movie. Like you sort of start to feel like you are helpless along with them in some ways. It's that immersive. And I felt like it had this sort of visceral effect on me, which was unpleasant, but unpleasant in the way you go to a movie for, you know, to be like transported in that way and feel like you were in a, you were somewhere other than a screening room on the East Side.
There's a suggestion from the very beginning, actually, that Sandra Bullock is going to throw up.
Right.
Right? Because yeah. she has space nausea at the beginning. And the whole first scene, you can, she acts it really well. She's kind of, you know, really not used to this kind of movement. But then as soon as the shower of space debris starts, she gets her space legs, I guess. But I spent the whole movie thinking somebody's going to throw up in a helmet and it's going to be really disgusting.
Thankfully, that doesn't happen.
The other thing we should maybe talk about with the 3D, which I agree was great. I think this is one of the best 3D movies I've seen. Like, it, I think it goes next to Avatar and Life of Pi and those movies. Is there's a lot, the one exception to that, the kind of thing, the thing that I would normally not like that I thought really worked here was just all of the shit that comes at the camera. It's just constant space debris flying at you to the extent that I was flinching in my seat and like nearly holding up my hands to protect my eyes kind of thing. And I don't know, I guess it's because the movie just felt like such a ride. Otherwise, it didn't bother me, or it felt so motivated, because how could you not have space to be flying at the camera when it's flying in every possible direction?
Well, it's also because it was using like different planes of space so inventively that there wasn't that house of wax sense that there was just a foreground and a background.
It wasn't so sudden. Right. There were always things in every,
Right. I mean, they're kind of the foreground and the background were always reversing each other, right, because there was kind of no polarity. And it did an amazing job at establishing that, I thought. All right, we should close this out. We could talk about Gravity all day, but in sum, we would send people despite reservations.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really think I have that many reservations. It's just the, like, you know, like the plot nitpicking, but like I said before, I think the plot actually holds up in the moment.
Yeah, this is one of the more memorable experiences I've had in the theater, and I think everybody should see it.
All right, well, let's have another one soon and talk about it.
Yeah.
Thank
you all
for coming in.
Hopefully not one this good.
Thank you all for coming in.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dana.
All right. Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.